My Dancing Day by Sir Richard Rodney Bennett, who died on Christmas Eve last year. Paul Brough conducted the BBC Singers.
Join me for a seasonal Sound of Cinema this weekend as we look back at Disney's changing musical sound.
Just whistle while you work.
With music from classic animations like Pinocchio, 101 Dalmatians, The Jungle Book and Mary Poppins.
It's supercalifragilisticexpialidocious, even though the sound of it is something quite atrocious.
And we'll look at what happened to the music during the so-called Disney Renaissance, with scores such as Alan Menken's The Little Mermaid and Hans Zimmer's The Lion King, some of the best-loved and most enduring music in cinema history. Join me, Matthew Sweet, for Sound of Cinema, Saturday afternoon at 4 on BBC Radio 3.
And there's music for the silver screen in just a couple of minutes. The John Wilson Orchestra's Hollywood Rhapsody Prom from last August. BBC Radio 3, it's just gone 7 o'clock, and this is Jonathan Swain in London with a summary of the news. Around 37,000 homes remain without power as a result of the severe storms earlier this week. Some homes in Kent, Surrey and Sussex may be without electricity until the end of the week. More than 100 flood warnings are in place for England, Wales and Scotland. Reports from Iraq say at least 34 people have been killed in car bomb attacks in mainly Christian areas of the capital Baghdad. Dozens more were wounded. Anglican leaders have used their Christmas Day sermons to condemn the poverty they say is inflicting misery on many Britons. In his first sermon as Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby called on Christians to challenge the greed and selfishness that contributed to the destitution in the UK. The Archbishop of York, John Sentamu, described poverty as a dark stain on the conscience of the nation. Pope Francis has expressed concern for conflict regions around the world in his first Christmas address since he was chosen to lead the Roman Catholic Church in March. He also drew the world's attention to the hardship and dangers faced by migrants who go in search of a better life. In her Christmas message, the Queen has looked back on some of the notable royal events of the year, including the 60th anniversary of her coronation. She also looked forward to the Commonwealth Games next year in Glasgow, and there was a special focus on the birth of her great-grandson, Prince George. Earlier, the Queen was joined by other members of the royal family for the traditional Christmas Day church services at Sandringham. Prince Harry and the Duke and Duchess of Cambridge were among the party, but Prince George stayed away. The Russian authorities are dropping criminal charges against all 30 people accused of taking part in the Greenpeace protest in the Arctic. The group were detained in September and held in custody for 2 months before they were released, pending a trial. Six activists are British. Egypt's military-backed interim government has declared the Muslim Brotherhood a terrorist group. In a statement, the government blamed the Brotherhood for the bombing of a police station yesterday, in which 15 people died, a charge denied by the group. Mohamed Morsi from the Muslim Brotherhood won the country's first democratic presidential election last year, before being deposed by the military in July. British troops are marking their final Christmas in Afghanistan before they pull out of the country next year. Some 5,000 servicemen and women are now working alongside the Afghan security forces, who are leading operations. And the weather: a dry and cold night for central and eastern areas, with frost and patchy fog possible. Elsewhere, it'll be cloudy with showers in southern England and northwest Scotland. Tomorrow, fog patches may be slow to clear, but it should be a drier day for a good many. And that's the news and the weather, with the time coming up to 3 minutes past seven. Well, now on Radio 3, another highlight from the 2013 Proms season, a Hollywood Rhapsody. It's introduced by Susie Klein.
The hall is packed tonight, the stage teeming with some of the UK's finest jazz, dance band and classical musicians, 108 of them in total, squeezing onto the platform here at the Royal Albert Hall. Yes, the John Wilson Orchestra is back at the Proms for a fifth consecutive year. In the past, they've brought us music from Broadway, MGM musicals, Rodgers and Hammerstein, among other things. Tonight, it's all about the golden age of Hollywood, as conductor John Wilson explained when I met him earlier today.
I thought it was time to do a show which wasn't based around song, because the last four or five or however many proms we've done have all, in one way or another, been musical theatre pieces, musical comedy pieces, American film musicals with songs at the heart. And I wanted to throw the spotlight back onto the orchestra and back onto those composers who wrote in the movie studios in that time so brilliantly for the orchestra. The players in this orchestra are all musicians who, as well as being technically terrific, absolutely see the point of this music. And they have the qualities to bring this music alive, the sort of ardour in their string playing, the sort of style in the brass and saxophone playing, and the sort of soloist quality in the winds and the French horns, and sheer devotion to the repertoire is the one overriding quality that they all share.
John Wilson talking to me earlier. Well, joining his hand-picked orchestra on stage here tonight, we have a trio of soloists from the West End, Broadway, and the opera world. The Russian soprano Venera Gimadyeva is making her UK debut. I heard her in rehearsals. She's going to be very exciting this evening, I think. Grammy-nominated jazz singer Jane Monheit is here. It's her first time at the proms. And Matthew Ford, big band star and a John Wilson regular, completes that trio. On the bill, in the first half tonight, we've Eric Korngold's fizzing music for Robin Hood, alongside music by some other real Hollywood greats. Bernard Herrmann, Alfred Hitchcock's composer choice, Bronislav Kaper, David Raxin, and with music by Alfred Newman kicking off this evening. Newman wrote more than 200 scores for Hollywood. He won 9 Oscars during his career. We'll hear his 1931 score for the movie Street Scene, and before that, opening proceedings tonight, probably the most famous clarion call in the whole of film history. I'll see if you can work it out for yourself, though. So I hope you have your popcorn at the ready, because we have a real celebration tonight of some of the very best orchestral music produced, I think, in the whole of the 20th century. And applause now for Andrew Haviron leading the John Wilson Orchestra tonight. And here he is. Tonight's conductor making a triumphant return to the platform of the Royal Albert Hall. It's John Wilson to conduct the John Wilson Orchestra. music by Alfred Newman, head of music at 20th Century Fox. And applause for principal trumpet Michael Lovett and the whole of the John Wilson Orchestra on their feet, opening their 2013 appearance at the BBC Proms. Music next by Bronislav Kaper.
Thank you.
David Raxin's suite, Laura. Applause for Gordon Campbell, lead trombone in the BBC Big Band and principal trumpet in the John Wilson Orchestra.
Thank you.
Once heard, never forgotten. Music for Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho, composed by Bernard Herrmann and formed here live at the BBC Proms by the John Wilson Orchestra, conducted by John Wilson. John Wilson making a gesture of stabbing the leader, Andrew Havron, with his baton in a slightly psycho-esque way. Well, it's more music by Bernard Herrmann next. Actually, his cinematic debut, and it wasn't a bad one, because the first score he ever got to write was for Citizen Kane, widely acclaimed as the finest film ever made. I don't know what you think, but I reckon that's how to sing a high D. The UK debut here at the Proms of Venera Gimadyeva, I suspect she'll be back here in the UK pretty soon singing again. Russian soprano, part of the ensemble at the Bolshoi Theatre in Moscow, making her Proms and UK debut here with the John Wilson Orchestra. Where to close part one, we have music next by Eric Korngold.
Thank you.
Eric Korngold's Sweet Robin Hood from the 1938 Warner Bros. Movie. Closing the first half of tonight's Prom from the John Wilson Orchestra, led tonight by Andrew Haveron. We are backstage here at the Royal Albert Hall, and I am delighted to be joined by tonight's conductor, John Wilson. Hello, congratulations on a first half.
Thank you.
You seem to be enjoying yourself, young man. You were smiling a lot.
And that was the scariest half, so I might even smile even more in the second half.
You are here, bat on your hand, so we do know you're going to be going on in the second half. You're not leaving the building.
Very soon, definitely.
Music in this half by Jerome Ross, Max Steiner, who was, you know, this amazing World War I emigre. How did you then put together? I mean, you have so much music to choose from, John, when it's Hollywood orchestral stalls. How did you go about fixing the programme?
First thing was to choose all the important composers, the sort of pioneers who created the sound of the golden age of Hollywood, and then to choose movies that people were familiar with, and some that they might know but would have terrific scores, and then most importantly, pieces which would stand up on their own in concert. So concert pieces.
But that sounds rather like a crossword or a jigsaw puzzle. Was it one of those things where it all fell into place, or how long does it take?
Endless. I mean, half a year. And, like, reshuffling all the time the order in which things go in the programme. And it is, as I said before, like a three-dimensional game of chess. One alteration to the programme and the whole lot can fall apart.
How many drafts are we talking about?
Nearly 50.
Really?
Yeah.
50?
Yeah, that many, literally.
OK, but now you're doing it and it's happening for real. You're happy with the way you did your concert?
I think I've got it right.
We'll find out in the second half. One of the highlights for me in rehearsals this morning was this Scott Bradley music, Tom and Jerry. Amazingly atmospheric. And we've got pistols going off and plates being shattered. And
The whole works, yeah.
How are you going to rein them all in? Because I can see how much fun they're having out there.
Oh, no, it's under control. It was in rehearsals, anyway. Goodness knows what they'll get up to.
The iron fist of John Wilson.
Ooh.
Do you find when you're in the middle of doing something like this, John, is there a bit of your brain that allows yourself to sort of float above it all and think, actually, this is fantastic, this is why I do this job, or is there too much concentration?
I try and enjoy it when we get to the concert. I'm pretty... My brain's engaged in rehearsals in a different way to the way it will be now.
Would allow you to be engaged because Tammy, our concert manager, is whisking John off. Have a fantastic second half. John Wilson making his way back to the stage. He's just in the bull run here of the Royal Albert Hall in the last few moments as the John Wilson Orchestra tunes. And we start the second half of tonight's Prom. Music by Jerome Ross, his score for The Big Country, a 1958 Western, starring Gregory Peck, Gene Simmons and Charlton Heston. John Wilson joining the players of his orchestra here at the Royal Albert Hall.
Thank you.
music by the first major emigre composer to arrive in Hollywood, Max Steiner, the writer of more than 300 film scores for Hollywood. That was his Casablanca suite performed by the John Wilson Orchestra in the celebration.
Is a wondrous thing that we'll rejoice in remembering. Our love was born with our first embrace, and a page was torn out of time. Our love affair, may it always be a flame to burn through eternity. So take my hand with a fervent prayer that we
just as sure as you live. Something's gotta give, something's gotta give, something's gotta give. When an irrepressible smile such as yours warms an old implacable heart such as mine, don't say no, because I insist. Somewhere, somehow, someone's gotta be kissed. So on guard, who knows what the fates might have in store from their vast, mysterious sky. I'll try hard, ignoring those lips that I adore. But how hard can anyone try? Fight, 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 fight it with all of our might. Chances are some heaven. As sure as we live.
Fairy tales can come true. It can happen to you if you're young at heart. For it's hard, you will find, to be narrow of mind if you're young at heart. And if you should survive to 105, look at all you'll derive out of being alive. And here is the best part, you'll have a head start if you are among the very young.
You saw the song begins, you speak, and I hear violins. It's magic. The stars desert the skies and rush to nestle in your eyes. It's magic. Without a golden wand, charms. Fantastic things begin when I am in your arms. When we walk hand in hand, the world becomes a wonderland. It's things that happen can really be true. When in my heart I know the magic is my love for you.
You see a pair of laughing eyes, suddenly your sighing sighs. You're thinking nothing's wrong, you string along, boy, then snap. Those eyes, those sighs, they're part of the tender trap. You're hand in hand beneath the trees. Soon there's music in the breeze. You're acting kind of smart until your heart just goes whap. Those trees, that breeze, they're part of the tender trap. Some starry night when her kisses make you tingle, she'll hold you tight and you'll hate yourself for being single. And all at once it seems so nice, the folks are throwing shoes and rides. You hurry to a spot that's just a dot on the map, and then you wonder how it all came about. It's too late now, there's no getting out. You fell in love, and love is the tender trap.
The night is like a lovely tune. Beware my foolish heart. How white the ever constant moon. Take care, my foolish heart. There's a line between love and fascination that's hard to see on an evening such as this. For they both feel the very same sensation when you're lost in the magic of a kiss. His lips are much too close to mine. Beware my foolish heart. But should our eager lips combine and let the fire start, for this time it is a fascination or a dream.
Three coins in the fountain, each one seeking happiness, thrown by three hopeful lovers. Which one will the fountain bless? Which one will the fountain bless?
Which one will the fountain play?
Once on a high and windy hill, in the morning mist, two lovers kissed, and the world stood still, and your fingers touched my silent heart and taught it how to sing. Yes, true love's a many splendid thing.
When the moon hits your eye like a big pizza pie, that's amore. You dance down the street with a cloud at your feet, you're in love. When you walk in a dream, but you know you're not dreaming, signore. Scusa me, but you see, back in old Napoli, that's amore.
When I was just a little girl, I asked my mother, she said to me, "Que sera, sera, whatever will be, the future's not ours to see, que sera, sera, what will be, que sera, sera."
Somebody loves you, it's no good unless she loves you. All the way. Happy to be near you when you need someone to cheer you. All the way. Taller than the tallest tree is. That's how it's got to feel. Deeper than the deep blue sea is. That's how deep it goes if it's real.
When somebody needs you, it's no good unless they need you. It's for sure I'm gonna love you all the way.
Hollywood movie theme medley sung by Matthew Ford and Jane Monheit here at the Proms, and applause from conductor John Wilson and his orchestra. Next this evening, music by Franz Waxman, A Place in the Sun from 1951. Fritz Waxman's A Place in the Sun, and riotous applause there for Howard McGill, who played that alto sax solo. Next tonight at the Proms from the John Wilson Orchestra. Well, it's going to be a whole load of cat and mouse commotion. Howard McGill on his feet there. Next, it's Tom and Jerry at MGM.
Thank you.
Bravo indeed, a virtuoso performance of virtuoso music. Scott Bradley's Tom and Jerry. Huge applause for David Jackson and Stephen Henderson, the percussionists in that. Got to smash plates, fire gardens and generally fool around. Here they come back onto the stage of the Royal Albert Hall to join the other players of the John Wilson Orchestra live here at the Proms. Well, next here this evening, we're slightly more epic than Cat and Mouse as we move into the tulip-filled domain of Ben-Hur. music from a movie that took a year to shoot, 9 months to edit, a whopping 72 hours in the studio to record Miklos Rocha's suitably epic score for Ben-Hur. Performed here at the Proms by the John Wilson Orchestra, conducted by John Wilson, the orchestra led tonight by Andrew Haveron. And the players so evidently enjoying themselves, throwing themselves into that concert. I mean, just to give you a sense of the quality of these players, just in the first violins, we've got the concertmaster of the Philharmonia, the co-leader of the Royal Scottish National Orchestra, guest leader of the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra, the leader of the Royal Northern Symphonia. This is just in the violins. Every one of these players is a leader in their field, and they all evidently love being here. Applause for tonight's conductor, John Wilson, returning to the stage here at the Royal Albert Hall. This whole project, the John Wilson Orchestra, started with a group of friends 20 years ago playing at Pizza in the Park in London. They played a few hotels, a few tea dances, and slowly the momentum grew. And their big break really coming at the Proms in 2009. They got the call to come here and they've been back every year since. Applause for the brass there, the saxophones, trumpets on their feet. And the trombones. Again, so much camaraderie between these people who don't always play together, but a great sense of fun and enjoyment, and also serious dedication to this music. These musicians want to play it at the highest possible level. And what I suppose John Wilson and his orchestra have done is give these scores, whether they're Hollywood, MGM, Broadway, a real sense of sophistication and authenticity. There we go. Huge round of applause for percussionists tonight, Stephen Henderson and David Jackson, who had such a great time in that Tom and Jerry medley. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is the sound of a capacity audience who have very much enjoyed themselves. He's back, here he is again, John Wilson, stepping back onto the podium.
The Ride of the Cossacks by Franz Waxman from his score for J. Lee Thompson's 1962 film of Gogol's Taras Bulba. And that was the encore given by John Wilson and his orchestra at the Hollywood Rhapsody Prom last August. And there's another visit to last summer's proms in just over half an hour here on Radio 3, a chance to hear Nigel Kennedy's latest approach to Vivaldi's Four Seasons. As Ivan Hewitt put it in the Telegraph, mingled in with Vivaldi's original were moments of discreetly loose jazz piano, a brief snatch of It Don't Mean a Thing If It Ain't Got That Swing, Latin percussion, beautifully plaintive Arabic folk-like cantillation, Balkan-style folk fiddling, momentary Spanish touches, a glimpse of the blues, and twittering bird sounds. Kennedy and his musicians turned Vivaldi's Four Seasons into a groovy, magical mystery tour. Well, that's all from 9:30 tonight. Before it, Joan Bakewell with another in her enlightening series of interviews on belief, and tonight she's talking to the actress Sally Phillips. For the moment, back to Korngold. He, it was Mahler, recognised as something of a genius when Korngold was only 10. Well, these are two Korngold Shakespeare settings from a good many years on, 1939, so the year after his score for The Adventures of Robin Hood. The first is Come Away Death, and after it, O Mistress Mine. The mezzo is Angelika Kirschlager and the pianist Helmut Deutsch.
Trick of the pretty sweet, for joy is in the
Oh, Mistress Mine, ending those two of Korngold's Songs of the Clown, the mezzo Angelika Kirschlager and the pianist Helmut Deutsch.
For Christmas week on BBC Radio 3, Composer of the Week brings you no partridges, no turtle doves, no hens, French or otherwise, no collier birds, whatever they are, forget the gold rings, but there may be a glimpse of a dancing lady, and possibly a piping piper, but for sure, quite a lot of drummers drumming, whole battalions of them, in fact, in a bumper package of Beethoven. I'll be opening five doors on episodes in Beethoven's life, from his first published music, written at the age of 12, to, at the other end of the scale, music which, when it was first heard, was said to show us a new world. Join me, Donald MacLeod, for Beethoven as Composer of the Week, every day this Christmas week at 12 noon on BBC Radio 3.
And if you missed the first three Composer of the Week programmes this week, they're all available on the BBC iPlayer on the Radio 3 website. This is BBC Radio 3. It's just gone 9 o'clock. And now, Belief with Joan Bakewell.
My conversation about Belief is with someone whose voice you might well know from Radio 4 and whose face is familiar from television comedy on the BBC, on Channel 4 and on Sky. Sally Phillips began making a name for herself as a comedy actress when she came down from Oxford in 1992. She's worked with comedy maestros Simon Pegg, Chris Morris and Steve Coogan. She's been Bridget Jones's best friend Shazza and Miranda's friend in Miranda. And she's a writer too, sketches for Channel 4's Smack the Pony and a film called Decoy Bride. She's currently starring in Claire in the Community for Radio 4. In 2003, she was listed in The Observer as one of the 50 funniest acts in British comedy. After years as a non-believer, she became a Christian, she says, on July the 17th, 1996, at 3 a.m. in Hammersmith Shopping Centre. She shares her life with her husband Andrew and their three sons, Ollie, Luke and Tom. Right, Sally, what's this about Hammersmith Shopping Centre at 3 a.m? It's not just a joke.
It's actually true. Yes, I was prayed for by a very Pentecostal Sierra Leonean Christian at 3 a.m, and it seemed only polite to submit at that point. Yeah, he prayed for me and I burst into tears and fantastically embarrassed, and people were sort of mopping the sick up around us. And as I walked away, I thought, that's so sad. You've just pretended to become a Christian to, bond with Patrice, as this very kind and a brilliant actor was called. But weirdly, I've just the next morning I was up at 9 to go to church for the first time since I was about 10, and I've carried on going ever since. I've constantly thought that I'm about to lose my faith and it's, you know, just a fad.
But you must have been in quite a receptive mood, apart from being a friend of his and wanting to please him, as we all do.
You know, you never know how far back to start these stories. I mean,
let's start with your background. Okay. You say, because you start at the beginning. Your childhood was a travelling childhood because your father's in British Airways. You were born.
I was born in Hong Kong.
So you were born in Hong Kong and you travelled to Zambia.
Zambia, and I've got two brothers, and my youngest brother was born in Brunei, and I have memories of showering in the rain in the garden and snakes getting into the house and my dad killing them with a hockey stick. We basically lived in the middle of a jungle, you know, and then, Beirut, and we evacuated when the war started. I have amazing memories of the Lebanon as it was. These memories of, you know, cedars and spicy sausages and skiing and country clubs and the ballet school.
So yeah, these are different cultures you've seen as a child, drinking in all these different influences. So that must have shaped how you think about the world.
It has enormously, because you sort of become, when you're overseas, you become English because you're not American and not German and not Dutch and not South African, all these things people think you might be. And I was very much, you know, we had World Service on all the time. Like, even when we left the house, the World Service was playing. And then it was quite a shock to come back to the UK as a teenager and discover that being English was actually about knowing smash hits inside out.
So, were your family devout? Was the church observation in any of these places?
No, in none of these places, apart from, hilariously, in Rome. So we lived in Rome for a while, and my mother, who does now go to church, became obsessed with church architecture. And she bought a gigantic poster on which was like a cigarette card sized picture of every single church in Rome. And as a family, we went to every single church in Rome. And when we'd finished, we went back and started doing them again. So the whole family became church phobic, you know, you sort of walk in, no! And we started saying, seen it, done it, and get very, very angry. And these teenagers being dragged around these.
But did you do any of the actual church observations? Did you say prayers? Did you sing hymns?
No, definitely not. Definitely, definitely not.
Then you came back to England and you went to a really rather posh boarding school.
Went to a very posh boarding school and, so I felt like an outsider. You know, I had like the, I remember things like I had the wrong pants. So we'd gone to Len Smith School Outfitters and bought white gym pants rather than just knowing that you could go in little floral M&S undies. So I had, you know, had big, thick nylon pants, which was just not okay. And
so these things made you feel
not one of the girls, but I don't know if I deliberately made myself an outsider or I mean, I've got a good friend Jemima who also had this, you know, I think it's called being a third culture kid, where you're brought up in a country that's not your parents' country of origin. She also had that. She said, oh, you just chose to stand outside it, which, you know, is probably true.
Does it help when you come to write comedy?
Definitely. I think most comics stand in some way outside. You'll find that they've got parents who are teachers, so they moved, they'll have had a couple of moves, or army, you know, Dawn and Jen, obviously both army kids, Miranda Hart's dad's in the Navy. There's a lot of itinerant childhoods there.
Now, you were at this school, which of course would be very conformist, so were you confirmed in the Church of England?
Yes, I was. My parents hadn't christened me because they didn't, I mean, I don't know how my mother will take me saying this, but certainly she never mentioned God to me growing up. You know, she was a big feminist, and we talked a lot about Ursula Le Guin, you know, and
that's all right.
Yeah, she did a great job. I mean, I was fed to Alan Garner and Weird Stoner Basingaman, and I suppose, you know, I got a big narrative of light against dark, but it was never put really in a Christian context.
And, so confirmation requires
requires you to be christened. So that was in a way interesting. So they said, you know, everyone in the year was getting confirmed, and I went home and said, oh, I want to get confirmed. And I said, well, you can't because you haven't been christened and left the kitchen. And then I said, why? What would have happened if I'd have died? So where that could have come from, I've got no idea. I had this idea that I would have gone straight to hell. I'd somehow absorbed, even though I don't think anyone had at that stage mentioned hell to me at all. That if I'm not saying I was correct either, just for the record, but there was clearly some kind of deep anxiety. So then, as was necessary at this time, as it was also necessary to pierce my own ears and do other acts of rebellion, I decided to get myself christened. And because this is embarrassing, I just made a, you know, huge joke of it. I got christened in the school chapel.
You joked about it?
A lot about it, yes. And I giggled all the way through. And up till the last minute, I was going to be christened Sally Sunset. I can't remember why. I thought that was hilarious at the time. Laughed all the way through. I mean, cried with laughter. And after that was over, I felt the most desperate shame.
Very naughty, at the least.
It was very naughty, and it it was very... But just a sense of, no, that's naughty of a whole different order. There's something, a feeling of there being something.
So then we go on to confirmation.
So then I got confirmed, and I took that pretty seriously.
Right, so what is it that you're taking seriously?
The Lord, that there might be a transcendent God who has opinions and deserves glory.
And that meant something to you quite seriously?
I tried to make it mean something, is probably the truth. Mm-hmm. So I you know, concentrated very hard on trying to visualise what that might be. And then I tried to join the Christian Union at school. The Christian Union was five people, and it was run by a maths teacher, very sweet maths teacher called Miss Fowler. But as is the way with all things Christian, not terribly cool. So five not terribly popular girls. And I arrogantly went, I'm going to make this trendy. This and ABBA, I'm going to repopularise both of them in my time here. This is my job. And I went along and just got very angry with it. So we had, you know, speakers come in and talk about how God had given them Volvos and God loves us, isn't that wonderful? And we're going up and everyone else is going down. And so that began a process of... I just went, oh, this is stupid.
So you go off to Oxford, where you get a first in Italian.
And become fantastically anti in my time there. So I arrive at Oxford and have the hilarious realisation, as happens to many women, I think, I'm oppressed. And this became my this became my identity. It turns your world upside down, doesn't it? This sort of just those curtains coming off and going, oh yes, oh I can see. I mean, the irony being, of course, that Oxford is the least sexist environment I've ever lived in my life.
And then you were in the Oxford Review.
Because I'd just done a one-woman show, Benedetta, the Life of a Lesbian Nun in Renaissance Italy, a true story of a total faker. And she was clearly an actress, basically. She started putting on voices, like doing the voice of Jesus, saying that there were angels coming to visit her. She could, you know, maybe a ventriloquist, doing all these different voices.
So you are rebelling here. Here you're being rude about religion.
Here I'm being quite rude about religion, yes. And
and you went up to the Edinburgh Fringe. And yes. It's on record that you did an hour-long show that you said was blasphemy from beginning to end, is that so?
Yes, yeah, that was my fourth year. I did Jesus too, like father, like son, like your neighbour, like yourself. He's back from the dead, he's crossed, he's everywhere, and he wants your soul. And
did you feel pangs of the girl who'd taken confirmation in her seriously?
Well, it's still the dialogue, isn't it? That's what's interesting now. You kind of go, well, and it's often the case with people who are very anti, that they're obsessed. I mean, Richard Dawkins comes across as obsessed as well, you know, and you kind of go, I wonder where that story's going to end up. And I just wonder if it's going to end up in the way it did for me, like if Richard Dawkins blubbing in, I don't know, that makes me laugh, West Kent Tube or something, Baron's Court.
So you're mocking religion among many other things, but the mockery is the tone of a university review, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I do wonder whether there's something about the tradition of mockery now in comedy, all over television, all the time, holding up sort of institutions of the state to ridicule day in and day out, whether you don't think that perhaps it can be damaging. I mean, if you constantly mock the institutions of the state, the church, the monarchy, anything, it begins to tell, and people begin to believe that you're telling them some truth about that institution.
Well, I think sometimes you are. I think sometimes you are.
When you were mocking the Christianity, did you want Christianity to be better than it was? Were you looking to improve it by your implied criticism of it?
I was just trying to think it through, actually. I mean, C.S. Lewis said I was the most reluctant convert in all of Christianity, and I reckon I would fight him for that title. Because it just felt like total social death, like being a terrible pariah coming out as being a Christian.
I'm taking you back to this Hammersmith shopping centre conversion. Because clearly a lot had been going on before then.
Yes.
And I read that you were concerned when you realised that there were people who were Satanists, and you were frightened by that. Is that true?
Yes, I just sound like such a nutter when I tell the story. I started writing, and this is before Father Ted, with my feminist agenda, started writing a sitcom about three generations of witches. So a grandmother, a mother and a daughter all running a cafe in Brighton. Also at Oxford there was a poster place. We used to get our posters made for university shows run by a wizard and a witch. And I'd gone in and been exhilarated by a long conversation I'd had with them where I said, so I'm a witch. And I said, you're in a coven. Yeah, that's right. So there's 13 of you in the coven and saying, so what do you do then? And the line that I loved was she said, we like harness the elements. We harness the elements. And, if one of our cats is sick, and that was, she didn't finish the sentence, that was it. Just this idea of these 13 people getting together to, you know, share jelly and harness the elements and deworm their cats by magic and stuff. I mean, I was crazed with joy at the idea of being able to write that kind of thing.
You took a pleasure in the absurdity of that.
In the absurdity of it. But then I started researching it and, you know, all the history of the possessed nuns of Wirtet who got turned into pigs. And it's fun. Everyone loves the surreal, you know, everyone loves it in Harry Potter, don't they? The any flavoured beans. It's all kind of, you know, magical thinking stuff. But I mean, in the research, I found people who could stop clocks by looking at them. And, you know, not being a physicist, I had a very pragmatic view of the world that I just thought that what I could see was... I thought that was a sensible thing or as physicists, of course, no, it's
all. Did you begin to believe that things like that could happen?
Yeah, and that was enormously shaking. And then I ended up having this nightmare every single night, pretty much, for 3 months. I was living on my own, and I would just feel an incredible evil. I'd see a Louis XIV chair in the room with gold rope round it, and I'd hear this voice saying, "The devil was bound, but now he's free." So naturally, I thought I was going insane and didn't tell anyone, because that was fantastically shaming to even be thinking about this kind of thing. So I stopped writing the sitcom. So I thought, my brain is a computer. I get out what I feed in. I'm feeding in witchcraft. Let's stop doing that, and this will stop.